Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
All right, heading up to training camp, Jake and I are giving you guys a countdown of the 15 most important Seahawks if Seattle wants to get back to a Super Bowl, and believe me, they do. We're already inside the top 10. Here's number 7, running back Chris Carson.
Counting down to the most interesting Seahawk on the 2021 roster with Jake and Stacy. Number 7.
The countdown continues with who else? Your starting running back, Chris Carson. Chris Carson, almost not a Seahawk this year, entered free agency, instead returns to the Seahawks on a 2-year, $10.4 million contract with a cap hit of just 2.5 this year. Pretty friendly cap hit. Now, that's thanks to some roster maneuvering that we can talk about later. But Chris Carson was a find for the Seahawks. Flashback to the year they drafted Carson. He was a 7th-round pick, kind of flew under the radar compared to other picks they had that year that everyone was focusing on, Malik McDowell being kind of the headliner there. Chris Carson ended up impressing in training camp. I still remember to this day a press conference, a player press conference at the podium. It was Doug Baldwin, and he was asked about some of the most important rookies. Hey, who's catching your eye? And he said Chris Carson. And he wasn't alone. Several guys did. All of a sudden, here we are at camp. Here we are as reporters saying, well, wait a minute. Have we been overlooking this Chris Carson guy? This guy that Pete Carroll handpicked out of Oklahoma State? What are we not paying attention to here? Chris Carson ends up appearing in 4 games that year, had a coming out game against the Colts, and then, of course, ends up breaking his leg in just kind of a devastating season-ending injury. Heading into that offseason, the Seahawks are looking to revamp their run game. They had an abysmal year in the run where their leader, I believe, was Mike Davis. Just one running back, J.D. McKissic, had a rushing touchdown. Russell Wilson otherwise led the team in both rushing touchdowns and rushing yards. So they head into the offseason, use a number, a first-round draft pick on Rashad Penny. They bring in the number one blocking tight end in free agency. They draft a great blocking tight end in Will Disley. They bring in a free agent guard and DJ Fluker that's supposed to be great in the run game. Everything is focused on fixing this run game. And Chris Carson, once again, people are like, well, he's going to be your starter, but you don't know what you have. And what do you end up having? You have Chris Carson becoming the first running back since Marshawn Lynch to rush for 1,000 yards in a season. The Seahawks end up leading the rest of the league with around 160 rushing yards per game. Just an absolutely like monster year from Carson. He does it again the following season. So, Jake, you have a new offensive coordinator that comes in. Russell was cooking last year. What makes Chris Carson your running back, one of your most important Seahawks this year?
Well, make no mistake about it. This was the biggest coup for the Seahawks of the offseason. Now, you could point to Carlos Dunlap being your close number two, but I think that John Schneider read that market really, really well and understood that Carlos Dunlap in a COVID offseason when your salary cap is completely crunched down, that look, he's just not going to command nearly as much. And also, unfortunately for him, being a Cincinnati Bengal for his entire career also ruined his star power. So you look at J.J. Watt, got a big-time deal with the Arizona Cardinals. Well, Carlos Dunlap had a better year than J.J. Watt last year, which was one of the reasons why I thought he was going to be gone. And he was going to get a higher salary because they're the same age, they're the same class, and Carlos Dunlap is healthier and has performed better than J.J. Watt. But obviously, J.J. Watt is the more flashier name. He's the flashier player. And Carlos Dunlap kind of slips through the cracks and gets pegged as one of those older defensive ends. You get him for half price. Chris Carson, on the other end, is 26 years old, playing really, really good football. Back-to-back 1,000-yard years in 2018, 2019. Last year in 2020, yeah, he only played 12 games, but he didn't suffer like a significant injury that he was trying to play through. It wasn't anything seriously damaging to his knees, to his shoulders, anything real structural. And he ended up having still a really good year. His rush numbers went down because they brought in Carlos Hyde last year. They wanted to try to save him as much as they possibly could to get him into the playoffs. That was the goal. That was the priority for the Seahawks. And as you mentioned, Russell was cooking, especially at the beginning of the year last year. And they kind of transitioned away from a heavy run game. And you saw Carson's rush total dip pretty much by 100 carries. I mean, that's a significant decrease in workload. Despite that, he had 4.8 yards average per carry and 5 touchdowns. So still a very, very good year for Chris Carson. And getting him back at the price point that you did was an absolute steal. And if this was in a regular market, Chris Carson would have got paid a lot more than what he did. Now, what he brings to the table is a guy that can be extremely dynamic in between the tackles. He runs hard. He is physical. He is willing to make contact. There's no doubt about that. And then the other thing that he does that is very underrated in his game is his ability to catch the football, is his ability to be a weapon in the screen game, his ability to be a weapon out on the edge in the perimeter as a pass catcher. He's not a guy that's going to go and run, you know, sluggos and receiver routes. But in terms of him getting out in space, just get him the ball in the space, get him the ball in the flat. He can make guys miss. He can get you positive yards. And that is something that Chris Carson is, I think, one of the underrated aspects about him. And I think that when you look at Chris Carson, he can be used in a variety of different ways that allows you to put a big body with the ball in his hands, one-on-one, hopefully with a perimeter defender who wants nothing to do with him. So now coming back to his running style, he is a downhill physical runner. He attacks it. He sees lanes. He trusts the running scheme and does an excellent job of having great vision, and his ability to cut back when things flow play side is excellent. And he's going to get a lot more opportunities to do that in this new scheme with Shane Waldron. This heavy zone scheme is going to allow Chris Carson to see the lane, put his foot in the ground and hit it, and also be able to have major cutback opportunities, which will put him in great positions. You saw Todd Gurley and what he was able to do with the Rams offense at his peak. I'm not saying Chris Carson is Todd Gurley in his prime, in his peak, but Chris Carson is, in my estimation, a top 10 running back in this league, and he is a top 5 pure running back in this league. So when you put the ball in his hands and you give him more opportunities, which I believe this offense will, I'm expecting another monster year from Chris Carson. I'm expecting him to have over 1,000 yards. I'm expecting him to have over eight touchdowns on the year. I think that this is going to be a big-time year for Chris Carson and this offense. They need it.
Now, that eight touchdowns would be the most since 2018 when he had 9, and I don't think any of us are expecting the Seahawks to be the kind of run-first offense they were in 2018 when they were the only team to run on well over 50% of all plays. I think they were like a 52-53% run-first team as opposed to pass-first. One thing, though, that Chris Carson will always be knocked for is going to be his injury history. But you know what, Jake? It's hard for me not to think that is a little bit overblown. Now, there is an injury concern. I'll say that. There's a difference between being injury prone and having some injury concerns. And it doesn't sound like there is, but there is. And what I mean by that is this. Every running back that's a top running back in the league might miss a game, 2-3 games. And I'll tell you what, good look at 2020 stats. You see the top running backs, let's say every running back to have 1,000 or more yards, one running back out of the 10 or so running backs to have 1,000 or more yards played in every single game, appeared in 16 games. You want to know who it was? Take one guess. Top running back in the league last year, it was Tennessee's Derrick Henry. He appeared in 16 games for the Titans, rushing for over 2,000 yards. He's just the next level. Unbelievable player. But everyone else, Dalvin Cook, 14 games. Jonathan Taylor, 15 games. Nick Chubb, 12 games. Alvin Kamara, Aaron Jones. Any one of these guys played 15, 14, 13, or 12 games. It is not weird for a starting running back to miss a game or two. And when you look at Chris Carson's stats, that's kind of what you see. 2018, 14 starts. 2019, 15. Starts. 2020 was 12 starts. Obviously, you take out his rookie season when he wasn't supposed to be your starter, wasn't your starter to start the year. I don't really look at that year as being a year when he like let you down, right, since you weren't counting on him. Outside of that, he's got like somewhat expected game starts when it comes to being a starting running back. And as you pointed out, Jake, most importantly, kind of a pure running back, a downhill, powerful runner that you're just going to be running into contact. And as you know, and as you've pointed out, he is one of the league leaders in broken tackles and yards per carry after those first couple tackles. So where do you look at it as far as the injury-prone label, your concerns about that for 2021? I mean, how are you dealing with that kind of label for Chris Carson when you're looking at him as being one of your most important Seahawks?
I think it's unfair. I think it's unfair for Chris Carson, but at the same time, I think what really rings out and what really stands out to people when they think about that is 2019. The fact that Chris Carson had this unbelievable year, and then by the end of the season, their running back depth went from great
to Marshawn
to
Lynch.
Yes, Marshawn Lynch coming off the street. Although it was fun and it was great to relive the glory days, and how fun was that moment? It was desperate. It was desperate times. And if Chris Carson had been healthy against that Green Bay Packer team in the playoffs, what would that have been? What would that have looked right. like? We don't know, right? And so that's always the question that you have in your mind. So I think unfairly, people really put a lot of weight into that situation. That wasn't the case this year. He missed 12 games, but he was healthy for the end of the year. He was healthy for the playoffs. And the fact is they just didn't utilize him at the right time. And so I think that that's why when Pete Carroll said, here's where our emphasis needs to be heading into 2021, he said, running the football. We got to do that better. And everyone freaked out, like, oh my gosh. And I think rightfully so, because everybody's wondering, is Pete Carroll going to go back and be stubborn about his way? And we need to get back to ground and pound. But what I think Pete Carroll's intention was, we're not going to go backwards as an offense. We see the exciting dynamic of where Russell Wilson is with the explosiveness of this offense, Tyler Lockett, DK Metcalf, but we have to utilize Chris Carson better. We have to utilize him as a playmaker, as a guy that can balance this whole thing up so that we don't have the imbalance that ended up having last year and the predictability that we had last year. And finally, when teams are playing cover two, when they're playing two high safeties and they are daring you to run the football, you have to turn around and hand that ball off to Chris Carson. You have to give that guy the opportunity to get them out of those situations. And I think that Chris Carson is a talented enough player where he can make his presence felt in a game where they have to start respecting Chris Carson and that running attack. And I think that that's going to be very, very important for this team as they move into 2021.
All right. And that is our most important Seahawks countdown. Continue today with running back Chris Carson. Make sure to tune in every single weekday at 1 p.m. as we start a new player on this list. And again, had to move that one up because we have Scott Service joining us at 1 p.m. We have just a minute here before four down territory. Thank you, Jake, for that profile of Chris Carson. And Mike, you and I were talking about Chris Carson a bit during the break. What's your overall attitude about him being back?
Well, first of all, I'm impressed he was even on your guys' list. I would have figured since he's a running back and they're never supposed to
wouldn't
use them, you guys
all.
Wouldn't have even put
Come
him on the
on.
List.
Come on, you need a great running back like Chris.
Do
this
you?
Team,
to
if
what?
If you look at Chris Carson's
Do play action
stats,
with?
Okay, Mike.
Let Rose cook.
No, you need a running back. I mean, this team can't be one-dimensional.
You do?
Yeah.
I thought you just threw it all the time and let Russ do his thing and throw it everywhere.
I mean, don't get me
cool.
wrong. Chris Carson, great pass catcher.
Big 12 football. He's an okay pass catcher. I don't know if I call
decent.
Great. He's
he
okay. Caught,
he had more yards than any other tight end last year.
I love Chris Carson. Why doesn't he get more respect around the league? Why didn't anybody want him in free agency?
I think my theory, and I choose to believe it even though I have no proof, which is how I go about a lot of things, is that because he was a seventh round pick, there's a stigma that will continue to follow him over the course of his career where people are going to feel like that many people can't be wrong about something. Mm. Clearly, this was a breakout season. Clearly, that was a breakout season. Instead of looking at the reality of his career, which is he was actually a pretty well-respected prospect, then suffered a serious injury and had to change his kind of path to college.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that may be it, but for whatever reason, the league just doesn't seem to value him. He never makes it onto lists. No one ever talks about him as a great player. It's always, every time an announcer comes in, they're always like, oh, and they got this Chris Carson kid who you probably have never heard of, but he's actually pretty good. And I don't know. It surprises me that he's never really been able to garner that level of respect. At some point, you have to look at it and say the league must think that other running backs are better than him. Now, I like Carson a lot. I assume they're going to use him a lot. I don't think Pete's going to give up on his balanced attack. So, yeah, I would put him on my interesting list for sure.
See, I think the problem is his style is more like a Derrick Henry style, but he's not as big and doesn't rush for 2,000 yards.
But nobody is, and nobody does.
Well, exactly. But then other running backs like Alvin Kamara can say, well, I had, you know, 500-600 receiving yards.
Good point.
All right. It is time for Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with quarterback guru, Jake Heaps.
Jake Heaps played in the NFL, played quarterback, was in the room with him, was in the fire. He's really a guru. He really played the game.
First down, Mike, which coordinator is under more pressure this season, Shane Waldron or Ken Norton?
Oh, it's definitely Shane Waldron. Brock and I spent some time on this morning on the podcast, which will be out later tonight. I think Shane Waldron's got one of the hardest jobs in Seattle right now. He is stuck squarely between two of the most powerful, influential figures in Seattle sports history who seem to not be on the same page. On one hand, he's got to make Pete Carroll happy, who wants balance, who wants to run the ball, physical football. And on the other hand, he's got pass happy, let Russ cook. Yeah, that's a really challenging spot to be in. And oh, by the way, he's got to teach this new offense, and he's got to get this offensive line whipped into shape, which was not the case last year. And he's going to be under, I think, very strict scrutiny from both fans and coaching staff and management. I don't know how many more offensive coordinators Pete can go through. So I would say there's a tremendous amount of pressure on Shane Waldron. I'm just assuming, as a former coach at Buckingham Brown and Nichols School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that he'll be just fine and able to handle it.
Second down. Stacy,
Curtis,
I want to know what the latest is on Alden Smith and what it means for the defensive line battle going into training camp.
All right, so the latest is from ESPN's Brady Henderson, breaking just a few minutes ago that Alden Smith's arraignment has been moved to August 24th, which means he is cleared to participate in Seahawks training camp. Now, earlier, he did not report to OTAs because, and Pete Carroll hinted at this, he may not have been in shape enough or like up to, you know, their physical standard to participate in what they wanted for practice. So Brady also adds that he is expected to participate in training camp and has presumably then gotten in much better shape in the 7-week interim period. So what I would caution, that's the latest on him from Brady Henderson. What I would caution is, like, it's still not a guarantee he's going to make this roster. I mean, you still have to see what he looks like out there. You don't know what this arraignment is going to be. But even outside of that, you've got a bit of a logjam at defensive end. This team is going to have to make probably a surprising cut of someone. Who knows who it'll be? I'm guessing it's not going to be Carlos Dunlap, but you've got Dunlap in there. Benson Mayoa, who had, I think, 6 sacks for this team last year. Where's Rasheem Green play? He can play both inside and outside, and they need some more depth inside. Same with Kerry Hyder. What about former first-round pick LJ Collier? All these guys are playing on different parts of the defensive line, but with a thin interior defensive line, maybe you value a guy that's more flexible over a guy that's just strictly a pass rusher. So we'll see how Alden Smith fits into this, but the latest, again, from ESPN's Brady Henderson, is that he is cleared and expected to participate in training camp.
Third down. Mike, is there a team or player you think is getting way too much hype ahead of this NFL season?
Like elsewhere in the league? Probably go with Matt Stafford. He always gets too much hype. For years, people have like considered Matt Stafford good when he's not.
Do you think it's the opposite of the Chris Carson thing?
Yes, he was a first-round pick, and so he's supposed to be great. He's never won a playoff game.
But he can throw the ball far. Detroit's bad,
and he throws the ball far. Like, dude, it's part of his job to fix a bad culture in Detroit. It's not entirely his job. Yeah, the coaches have something to do with it, management, ownership, etc. But come on. How many years was he there without winning a single playoff game? He throws a ton of picks. Now, he's gotten better at that in the last couple of years. So some of my issues with him, I've had to kind of curb because he's done a good job of curbing his interceptions. I got to give some credit where it's due. But he's super overrated. He's kind of Jay Cutler-y to me.
Now, I think, well, he's more likable than Cutler.
Not by much.
Seems like a smart quarterback, at least. But I think, now, I think what it is with Stafford is that he has so many raw skills. It's like the John Elway thing. You see what seems like a complete package of a quarterback, and you have to believe, based on all the knowledge you have, that it has to work in the right system.
You ever gone into a game against the Lions and been like, oh, God, we got to face Stafford?
Well,
like, I've just never thought that, ever.
But I am worried about facing the Rams this year with the offensive weapons they have, specifically the receivers against Seattle's secondary.
I'm worried about facing the Rams too, but it has nothing to do with their offense and everything to do with Aaron Donald.
I think it's the fact that Jared Goff, when he was bad at football, looked like he did not know how to throw football. And Matt Stafford's not the same.
There is some of that. That's true. Matt Stafford is better than Jared Goff, but still getting too much hype.
Fourth down. Stacey, Gerald Everett or any other tight end for the Seahawks has a chance to do something that hasn't been done since 2017. What is that?
Curtis, a phenomenal question, and I'm so glad you asked because it gives us, you and I, a chance to talk about the best Seahawks tight end in franchise history.
Is that one James Graham? Well, Jimmy.
Jimmy. I think Jimmy's his
birthday. I
think his government's name,
yeah.
Jimmy Graham.
Is it Jimmy Graham?
It is Jimmy Graham,
okay.
Curtis, because since 2017, which is Graham's last season with Seattle, no Seahawks tight end has started 13 or more games or surpassed 400 yards. And those don't seem like super impressive numbers, but consider that Graham was your leading receiver and started at least 13 games in 2016. He had 15 starts with almost 1,000 yards. In 2017, he had 13 starts with 520 yards, but 10 touchdowns because they finally figured out how to find him in the red zone. Then in 2018, 19, and 20, you have three different tight ends that become your starter. Neither of those guys really make significant contributions in terms of just yardage. You haven't really had a reliable, true, top-tier tight end of one for this team. I don't know if Gerald Everett is going to come close to being Jimmy Graham at his peak. He probably won't. But can he give you more than 400 yards? Can he appear in 13 or more games? I think that would help your offense a lot.
It sure would. I still maintain that trading for Jimmy Graham is the worst decision the Seahawks have ever made during the John Schneider era, that it went completely counter to what their identity was. So you're going to have a hard time selling me on be more like Jimmy Graham.
It did, but here's the mistake that I think people make is thinking that the problem was Jimmy Graham and not the problem was the trade.
Say it again?
Oh, like,
well, no, the problem was,
the, well,
was,
the problem was
your
you
identity.
Got, well,
you said
yeah.
you wanted to be a physical running football team and then you traded for a soft catching tight end.
Now, was he soft or was he just acutely emotional?
Doesn't matter. He didn't want to block. And if you wanted to play...
He never blocked!
That's the point. I'm not blaming him.
Yeah.
He was the wrong guy for them to acquire. If I tell you I want to be a physical run-first football team, what should my tight ends be good at? Blocking.
Well, yeah.
So why in the world would you go after Jimmy Graham?
Well, he's dope and he scores touchdowns.
Yeah, because he's cool.
But this isn't fantasy football, and I think the Seahawks got caught up in a fantasy play instead of... Now, look, if you want to be the Saints or you want to be the Rams, Jimmy Graham's great. It's not a shot at Jimmy Graham. It's a shot at what you say you want to do and actually going out and trying to accomplish it.
Well, and I think the biggest problem outside of just that trade, and I completely, completely agree because it goes to the same point about it being kind of conflicting with their identity, is that they never then tried to make good on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you made the trade, and then instead of by midway through year three being like, hey, we're giving Jimmy Graham like two targets and asking him to block and our quarterback's getting sacked, you didn't figure out how to just, you know what, put him in the red zone. Just put him in the end zone during red zone things. Like, let's throw it to him a million times.
They wanted to run the ball. That was who they said they wanted to be. I mean, like, he didn't fit with what they wanted. In retrospect, it's totally ridiculous.
It was like getting the really, really expensive thing that you never actually wear out.
Like, yes.
You got it to have it, but then you realize it doesn't fit with your lifestyle.
It's like, hey, you know what? I'm going to have a really big family. I want to have 5 or 6 kids. You know what? I really think I should buy a Ferrari. It's just like, well, okay, how are you going to get your kids around? Hey, don't worry about that. The kids are just going to have to figure out how to cram into the back of the Ferrari. Well, the Ferrari doesn't have a back. All right. Well, I'm going to figure... Like, it just doesn't
now,
work.
Now, what I will not
buy
budge
a Suburban,
from,
for God's sake.
What I will not budge from, and I know that Curtis won't, is even knowing that and agreeing with you fully, Jimmy Graham, best tight end in Seahawks history.
True. And it's not even close.
No, all right. Cut off Mike's mic there so we can't
there
disagree.
There you go. Can't say anything.
Are Astros fans the softest fan base in American professional sports? A Twitter spat from last night tells me yes, but Salk might disagree. That's next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacy.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
All right, it is The Timeline on Jake and Stacey. By the way, Jake on paternity leave, so Mike Salk filling in for him today
yes.
and Thursday. Reminder, you've got that matinee tomorrow, so we're going to have Bumpus on with us, and we've got a short show, but we will be out at training camp. Now, before I get to any football news, and we do have one, not Seahawks related, but is Gardner Minshew related? Curtis is ready to sound off about that. Now, hold on, Curtis. Before we get to it, before we get to your complaint, are Astros fans... I want to hear your guys' response, 710-710, Mac and Jack's text line. Are Astros fans the softest fan base in American professional sports? Before you answer, know this. I know that I, a Seattle radio host, am dedicating minutes of my day currently talking about a fan base that's not listening to me. And it would make me seem like I'm soft and I'm petty. But let me tell you what. I saw so many Astros fans trying to fight with Mariners fans last night, starting by telling them, like, oh, you guys, it started with Joe Fan of NBC Sports Northwest posted a picture of these two guys in garbage can costumes at the game. And then Astros Twitter sounds off about it. Everyone's retweeting it. Oh, you guys are pathetic, blah, blah, blah. So many of the insults were like, you guys haven't made the playoffs. Say, hey, talk to me when you've made the playoffs. And it's like, you can't hurt us anymore. I think Mariners fans might be the least soft of any fan base because you have to be weirdly specific and creative with your insults. Like, weirdly specific. Like, Curtis, what would hurt you more? Someone saying, well, your team hasn't been in the playoffs? Or someone saying, remember when you drafted a catcher third overall in 2005?
Oh, yeah, the Jeff Clement one. Yeah. That would sting.
Like, that's what hurts more. You've got to be really, you got to put the work in to insult Mariners fans. Where with the Astros, all you have to do for a number one team in your division is say, you guys are cheaters, and they freak out.
You don't think they're used to it but yet? Like, they haven't figured that out?
No, they have not. Their collective IQ is, like, 38.
Well, they live in kind of a sad city. I mean, you kind of have some, like, most of the awful or soft fan bases are from really lousy city. I mean, we were talking earlier about the St. Louis Cardinals being on this list and their fans. St. Louis is probably the worst city in America.
You think worse than the worst city in America?
Yes.
I don't know about major cities?
Hot all
day. St. Louis
all day.
St. Louis, seriously, is a dump. I've been to most of the major cities in America. It's worse than Cleveland.
We have
it's not
dozens
close.
Of St. Louis listeners, so be very careful.
I don't care. That city's a dump, man. Like, I've been there a couple times, and each time it's just like, oh, this city's awful. The weather stinks. The architecture stinks. It's crime-ridden. You go downtown, and it's ugly. There's not good food other than barbecue some places on the outskirts. It's a terrible city. It really is. And Cardinals fans are awful. They're mean-spirited, they're soft, they've got rabbit ears, they're racist. Like, it's just, they're terrible. That's a bit of a broad brush. Let me be clear. But there's a lot of segments of that fan base that I want no part of.
Do you think that the worst fan bases are from the most successful sports cities?
Well, they're different. They're arrogant. That's an arrogant fan base, right? Boston, New York, Tampa Bay. I mean,
they're
really
insufferable to me.
The most successful, sports cities out there.
Let me tell you what, Tampa Bay is just maybe the worst of them.
You get some
success.
Of those octogenarians, man. They are mad,
they're
and they
horrible.
Will let you know about
because
how
they talk
been
to
doing.
You about the Bucks, and then they talk to you about World War II.
And the Lightning, don't forget.
That's exactly right.
Bucks, Lightning, World War II.
Those three categories they will not shut up about. They won't shut up about it.
Day in the life in St. Pete.
I think that, though, the Astros, my theory is that Astros fans don't have to tell us that the Astros, with their talent level, could have won the World Series in 2017. And so they forget that when we say, oh, you guys cheated, it's a critique of cheating in the way that they did it, and almost more so a critique of their lack of self-awareness after the fact than it was of saying they weren't good enough to win. You were good enough to win. It's why we're baffled you cheated.
I'm looking at some of these text messages about other bad cities.
What
Sacramento is bad. I agree with you on that. But that's a teeny little city. I mean, that's not pretending to be a real city. It's like the ninth biggest city in California.
Yeah, it's like collectively four Starbucks and like a nice
restaurant.
You can't
take a shot at Sacramento.
No,
that's
leave
like,
Sacramento
That's
alone.
Not a real city. Jacksonville. If Jacksonville didn't have a beach nearby, it would be unbearable. Yeah, but it does have a beach nearby, so it's worse than St. Louis.
Also, the Jags have been awful for so long. So again, my theory stands. It's the most successful sports teams or sports teams that are like maybe for the last 10 years they've been successful, and then they're like embroiled in controversy.
This says no, it's Indianapolis. Utter trash, worst city ever. Totally disagree. I've been to Indianapolis, went there for the baseball winter meetings. Cool little city. It's small. It's not a large city. But it's kind of got a fun little vibe to it. It's got a redeveloped downtown. Like, Indianapolis is kind of nice.
All right. Well, you guys have great answers here. Again, Salk is going with St. Louis. I'm going with Astros fans. Curtis, I'm going to take you siding with me on this one. Also, next story here, if you're seeing Gardner Minshew trending on Twitter, well, that's because of this colorful response when he was asked about being Trevor Lawrence's backup.
I was doing some digging, man. You know, before you were a football star, you were on the Brandon First United Methodist Church Basketball league team, okay? And I'm reading that you guys beat a team 60-2.
That's right.
Do you ever worry about going to hell because of that?
No. You know, I feel like, you know, maybe they should worry about, you know, not, you know, playing to the best of their abilities. You know, I play to glorify the Lord. That's what I was doing.
There we go.
Do you think the Lord likes half asses? I don't think so.
Curtis, that's funny.
I mean,
I think Gardner Minshew is objectively funny.
Gardner Minshew tries to play this aw shucks character, and it's him trying too hard.
I think that's him. I think that's him, and you don't want to believe it. He is Uncle Rico.
There was also the cut of him, and I couldn't find it, but it was him asked about being Trevor Lawrence's backup, and he's like, I haven't gone to the bathroom in 2 weeks because number two isn't an option.
That's hilarious.
No, no.
Salk is being very quiet on this one. Don't want to sound off about Gardner Minshew.
I am tired of Gardner Minshew.
All right, well,
I'm
Salk,
fatigued.
I'll let you sound off on this one because you've been following very
Mike
closely.
Mike agrees with me. I'm just not going to say
I do agree with Chris.
The Kraken. Kraken first-round pick Matty Beniers, who went to your rival high school, took a dig at the Seahawks in his introductory press conference.
You know, I've been in Boston my whole life, been out here, and I haven't gone too far away, but, you know, I actually like the Seattle Seahawks. You know, I am obviously a diehard Patriots fan, and you kind of gave us that Super Bowl, but...
Bold choice. Matthew, now I...
Young Matthew,
come listen.
Sit.
I will say this. We were going to have Matty Beniers on the show with us, but we had a scheduling conflict, and so we had to cancel. Salk's theory, though.
Yeah.
Is that?
Well, he's afraid. He didn't want to, you know, match wits with a BBNN guy, obviously.
Yeah, can you explain what BBNN is?
Oh, it's my high school. Right. He went to Milton High, Milton Academy.
Bed Bath & Neon.
Yes, Bed Bath & Beyond. That's the name of my high school.
Neon.
It sounds so much worse when I say Buckingham Brown & Nichols. That really makes it sound more elitist. But
yeah, you sound like you guys wore little penny loafers.
We didn't.
And...
No uniforms. Thanks. No.
You ever seen that show Madeline, the little cartoon with the French girl?
No.
That's how I imagine your high school was.
Dead Poets Society.
That was filmed at Middlesex,
first of all,
which was another school
in
our league.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Captain, my Captain.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you guys read poetry and
That was school. I'm sorry. That was School Ties that was filmed at Middlesex.
So
different one.
Now, Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what we did.
God,
like reciting poetry.
So
and,
insufferable.
Yes,
I can't even.
That's
stand
exactly
it.
What caves. We did. Hey, don't you like the fact that Beniers though is like not doing the like. Trying to fit in type thing, like stock answer. Like, yeah, I'm a Patriots fan, and thanks for giving me the Super Bowl. Like, I kind of like that. He's still willing to show who he is.
Yes, I appreciate the attitude, even though we've just been talking about how Patriots fans and Astros fans can be insufferable.
Can be
I
tough.
Still respect it.
For sure.
I respect a level of dedication to being unlikable.
Yeah.
You really have to. All right. I loved this question from Mike Salk. We're going to answer it next. Here it is. How can we measure success for Shane Waldron in his first year as Seahawks offensive coordinator? This is Jake and Stacey. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Mike, do you think you're on the famous alumni page, Wikipedia page for your high school?
For BBNN? No, probably not. We got some actual famous alums.
Yeah, we have famous alums. At mine.
I believe it.
Yeah.
The Green River Killer.
Yeah, he's
probably
famous.
The most famous.
Okay, well, how many of your alumni have multiple documentaries and podcasts about them? Riddle me that, Riddler.
Probably none, I guess. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mike, you brought up an interesting question when we were doing our show emails, and I found myself thinking about it and then like typing, backspacing a lot of ideas I had. So you introduced the question of how can you measure success for Shane Waldron in his first year as Seahawks? Why is it especially tricky to do that? It's not a simple answer.
Well, because he's a coordinator, right? He's going to step into this offensive coordinator role. He doesn't have stats that we can point to, right? It's not like, you know, hey, how was the running back this year? Well, he had a 4.2 yard per carry average, so I know roughly how good he was. I mean, we can look at their, you know, some of the advanced metrics and see if their yard per play average and stuff is improving and how many first downs they have and what they do in some certain spots. So there are some specific measurable tools, obviously, that you can look at. But I think with a coordinator like him, some of it will be creativity, which is harder to measure. Mm-hmm. Some of it is when do they come up with easy completions? What does their offense look like? I mean, under Darrell Bevell, and no shot at him, there were times where the Seahawks just looked, it looked like 31 other teams were playing one type of football, and the Seahawks played something that looked nothing like it.
You mean when they faced them on defense, or you watched 31 other offenses?
31 other offenses looked one way. They looked recognizable as NFL offenses, and then the Seahawks looked like they were just playing a different game. Not always bad.
Yeah.
Sometimes it worked out very well, but it's just like, man, their games don't look anything like other NFL teams.
Why was
do.
That?
I don't know. I could never, like... Because Russell was running around and the offensive line would never do anything and they'd run the ball more. And they're like every completion seemed like it took max effort for them.
Like it was improbable.
Yeah.
I don't know if they can do that again.
It was like, geez, could they pull out another 12-yard pass? I don't know. And so, I don't know, they always just look different. I thought they took some steps towards normalcy under Brian Schottenheimer the last few years. But again, your offensive line is just such a disaster that I think it really has never allowed any of these coordinators to truly implement their vision. And now all of a sudden you bring in Waldron, and a huge part of why he's here is the offensive line scheme. That's part of it, integrated in to his entire offensive philosophy. So how do you plan to judge him? I mean, quite frankly, if he can just get them to the line of scrimmage with more than 3 seconds left on the play clock, he'll be way ahead of the last two offensive coordinators, and I'll be impressed if they don't have to call timeouts in the second half the whole time.
Well, and I wonder, too, if there's going to be any additional context we're going to need to add at the end of the year. Like, would Shane Waldron have been more effective? Let's say it's, you know, January, and we're talking about the offense as we see it through most of the season. Would this offensive look differently if they had a better offensive line? Because the Rams had a higher rated offensive line during LA's most successful seasons when Shane Waldron was pass game coordinator. Did he need different weapons at receiver or tight end? You know what I mean? Like, there's going to be, no matter what, even if they're wildly successful, questions about context afterward, because Seattle is going to have a different set of weapons than LA
sure.
did.
But ultimately, they have a better quarterback, right? I mean, they have Russell Wilson, which is something that Waldron never had during his time there. They've got a running back that they just spent money on in the offseason because they like him. They've got a superstar in DK Metcalf, a good receiver, if not a star, in Tyler Lockett.
Is your offensive line good enough?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if not, then they should have spent more resources there in the offseason. I mean, they only did one thing on the offensive line in the offseason, signing Gabe Jackson or trading for Gabe Jackson. Right. So if that isn't enough, it's certainly on them. They had opportunities to do more on the offensive line. They decided that all they wanted to do was add one player to that O-line. So no excuses, man. So I don't know. How will you look at it? Like, what does success look like for Shane Waldron?
Yeah, so initially I was thinking of more advanced metrics. Like, okay, rather than like yards per game and these basic things, let's look at where this team has floundered in recent years and then see if there are measurable improvements, right? So, I mean, basic metrics would be, like you said, third down conversions. But let's say that they've really struggled with certain looks, or they've struggled to get receivers open in space. Like, little things. Are they better with that? Because those are usually correlated with wins. Then, as I was writing all of that, I was like, well, if I'm thinking of what their biggest problem was last year, yeah, I can think of some of these, but it feels like overall it was just not adapting. Mm. And you mentioned the New York Giants game the other day. I think it's a perfect point. It felt like they were just stubbornly sticking with a plan that wasn't working, and they didn't have a backup. And we're looking in from the outside, but that to me was not adapting. And we heard Tyler Lockett, nicest guy, who I don't think meant to throw anyone under the bus at all intentionally, said after the season, well, we failed to adapt. Mm. That's a problem. You are a professional NFL offensive staff and you can't adapt, and your own players, including players that would never hurt anyone or be slick about any kind of trash talk, is saying you didn't adapt.
He meant over the course of the season, not in a game. Not like, hey, we had a plan in the first quarter, didn't work. He meant over the course of the season,
yes.
Other teams took away what they were trying to do,
yep.
And they didn't have an answer.
Yes.
So to be more specific.
Yeah, what he meant was we were really attacking them downfield. And that's always kind of the basic understanding of how the offense wanted to be, is basically like a deep play action pass, mm-hmm. and then like you inch forward. The run game wasn't really always there, in part because of some health issues, and they struggled to always get it going. So for a while, it was just a bomb to Lockett, a bomb to Metcalf, a bomb to Lockett, over and over and over again. And then defenses started to play more too high coverage, and they started to cover those guys more carefully. And they didn't, I mean, this is a very, very simple explanation, but the biggest critique you hear is they didn't expand their intermediate pass game. And there's been people saying, well, Wilson's too short to do that anyway. But you didn't try doing something?
So let's say they expand their intermediary pass game now. Okay, so is he a better coordinator?
I mean,
Pete Carroll's philosophy has always been run it, run it, run it, chunk play. Run it, run it, run it, chunk play.
Yeah.
He wants physical running game and chunk plays in the passing game. That's what Pete's looking for. So,
I mean, maybe part of adapting is not always doing that. Maybe part of adapting is... Having this is what the Rams did so well that made them so tricky to cover, is you'd have the same play, but going to the other side and a completely different guy would run it. And it would go against your basic knowledge of what you're assuming a tight end does or a running back does. And when we had Curtis, who was the radio analyst that we had on with us?
DeMarco Farr?
Oh, duh. Go Dogs. We had DeMarco Farr on with us, and he said that the best offensive minds in football, he's learned, are guys that really understand how to use the rules of defense against the defense.
Yeah, so I see some value to all that, but let me sort of point the hole in it, which is now more than ever, NFL teams and coordinators and coaches have less time than ever with the players on the field practicing. You can't major in everything. Mm-hmm. You've got to pick something to be great at. Say what you want about Schottenheimer. He picked it. He wanted to be great at getting the ball deep, and they were. I think that it's harder to be good at everything in today's modern NFL because the veterans have basically said we're not practicing anymore.
It is. So let's say you're not going to do as many dump-off passes, or you're not going to throw it 62 times or 62% of the time, which is totally fine. That would be a lot for them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've made part of your identity and part of what you're going to excel at, part of your major, the run game. That wasn't there as much last year. And I know what you're going to say is, well, you want Russell to pass all the time, but you still need to open that up. And the problem is that they didn't have that consistently enough and honestly could have done it more.
Get to start finding out tomorrow, man. We're going to get to see his offense in action. Pretty excited.
All right. So really, really excited. I'm always excited when Scott Service joins us, but I am especially excited after this game. So Mariners insider for 710sports.com, Shannon Dreyer, is going to join Mike Salk and myself, and we are going to welcome on Scott Service, and we have plenty to ask him. Don't go anywhere. That's next.